Welcome to Lexis, the podcast all about language and linguistics. I'm Lisa Casey.
I'm Jackie Glancy.
And I'm Dan Clayton. On this episode of Lexis, we're really pleased to welcome Dr. Kingsley Ugwuanyi, who is a postdoctoral research fellow at SOAS in London as part of the School of Languages, Cultures and Linguistics. And we're going to be talking to him about world Englishes, global Englishes, and particularly West African English. So thanks very much for joining us, Kingsley.
Thank you so much, Dan.
First thing to focus on, I suppose, is a bit about the kind of history of the English language in Nigeria and maybe, yeah, also perhaps other parts of West Africa. What would you say are the kind of key landmarks in the sort of development of English in Nigeria?
Yeah, I would say the history of English is in Nigeria is quite similar to the history of English in West Africa. Yeah, so I will use Nigeria as example, which is a more comfortable and familiar with. Yeah, but it's pretty much quite close to what happened in what are English-speaking West Africa, Ghana, Cameroon, and the likes. I think there are three key historical events that give birth to the implantation of English in Nigeria as it is. One, the first one was transatlantic trade, which began maybe somewhere. Of course, the first European merchants to visit the West African coastal communities were the Portuguese, right? But as far back as the 15th century, but they were more or less displaced, so to speak, by the British merchants around the 17th century. So the first historical event is this trade, which even became more prominent when the slave trade became a very booming business at the time. That was around 17th, early 18th century. All right, so this was the first time, the first historical event. And then the second one would be the Christian missionary expeditions, which took place around the 18th to 19th, as well as also early 20th century. Of course, the language of Christianity, as you were, at the time was English. So most of the missionaries came establishing not just churches, but also schools, all right, which laid the foundation of English. And then which the third historical event, of course, is colonialism. So it's from trade to Christian missionary expedition and then to colonialism. And formal colonialism started in Nigeria in 1900, but before this time, English was already there, right? But more used in the southern part of the country, because that is where Christianity first came. And it's also the coastal communities are also in the southern part of the country. So English first was implanted in Nigeria in the south, but colonialism helped to spread English further afield into northern Nigeria across the length and breadth of Nigeria. So I would say the history of English in Nigeria is the history of transatlantic trade and missionary activities and then colonialism.
Right. And so 1900 as a kind of date as well, is that significant in terms of, you know, a particular status being given to English within Nigeria?
Yes, yeah. Even though, yeah, there has been wide the penetration of British people, especially from the Christian perspective, was already there before that date. But that date, 1900, was when it was colonialism formally started with the Royal Niger Company set up. So it is taken as the time that English was officially instituted as the language of colonial administration.
Right. All right. Okay. Yeah.
Yes. And that's from some kind of legal instrument that enforced the use of English as the language of governance at the time.
And so that was sort of imposed as a kind of, you know, a language of governance on a population who would have had some access to English in various ways, as you say, you know, in the South particularly, but a country that had and still has many other languages as well, doesn't it?
Yes, exactly. And at that time, English was still elitist in the sense that not the, the population, the speaker population of English at the time was still quite small, because most people who spoke English were teachers, interpreters, people who worked, administrators, civil servants who worked in colonial administration. So English was purely an elitist language. But then there was another language, the Nigerian Pidgin, all right, which is regarded as the language of trade, right? So most people, but at the time it had not spread across the country. Today it's a very, very common lingua franca in Nigeria.
Right.
But it was, and it has this Lexis, it's a mishmash of English, Portuguese, indigenous languages. And yes, English was then imposed on these people who spoke. Currently, there are over about 529 languages spoken in Nigeria. So,
quite a lot.
It's one of the most linguistically complex countries of the world. I think has the third highest number of languages after New Papua and Indonesia, I think. So English was imposed as the language for ease of governance, I believe. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So actually quite a similar picture to something like, you know, the British Empire in India.
It's a similar story. Across the British Empire of the time.
And so Nigerian independence in 1960, did that have a particular impact on the use of English, or did things basically stay the same?
Well, in reality, things stayed the same, but the conversations took place about, now that the colonizers have left, shall we also send their language packing as well? And the conversation hasn't died down to today, right? And I'll speak more about it later, but that's part of the motivations for my doctoral research. It hasn't completely died down, but then, after independence, it was proposed that people thought we could do away with English. But by that time, many more people have learned English.
Yeah.
And it was proposed that there would be four official languages: Igbo, Hausa, and Yoruba, the languages spoken by the larger ethnic groups.
Right.
Right. But this is just three languages out of, I've just said, over 500 languages. So the speakers of the other languages, the minoritized languages, feel marginalized because they do not see themselves in the other three. They are called three national languages. The other three national languages, they do not see themselves in those languages. So, of course, you see, even though that the speakers of Hausa, Igbo, and Yoruba are more in number, put together, but you find that they just constitute like about half of the entire population. So the other half feel that if you choose Hausa or Yoruba or Igbo as the official language, or even three of them together, they still would not find themselves in them. So that the way out is to use English, which in this case is considered ethnically neutral.
That's all right. It's an interesting concept, isn't it?
Yeah. So English is ethnically neutral, but also that idea of foreignness, that this language did not originate from us. It came from somewhere. And it also has that, it comes with that colonial attachment sense that we were colonized. Continuing to use this language will continue to remind us that we were colonized by these people, right? So the debate it's no longer as hot as it was maybe in the early 60s after independence, but English has been retained for practical purposes and also for the sake that no group will say we've been sidelined, so to speak.
Okay, no, that's interesting. Yeah. I mean, as you say, we'll probably come on to talk a bit more about sort of ideas and sort of ownership and that kind of side of things in a bit. Yeah. So your PhD that you mentioned, you said you'd looked at English language ownership perceptions of speakers of Nigerian English.
Yeah.
You asked some really interesting questions in there about the changing perceptions of English among Nigerian English speakers. So what kind of spurred that research, and what were your main findings with that?
Yeah, I would say before I started my PhD, I was teaching in a university in Nigeria. It's called the University of Nigeria, and it attracts people from all over the country. It's one of the most prestigious universities. I have people who come from Lagos, from Abuja, from all these cities. So I started noticing that some of my students could not speak any other indigenous Nigerian languages. So I found that some of my students were monolinguals of English. So they spoke only English. And in personal conversations with them, and I started asking myself, would these ones consider themselves native speakers? What does native mean? Or native speakers of English or native speakers of Nigerian English? I mean, the term native speaker is a term I do not like to use.
No, right? No, it's a problematic.
For obvious reasons, right? But L1 speakers, I wanted to know, that showed me that there is now greater penetration of English. English is no longer used in such official school domains only. It's beginning to perform greater function, even in people's private lives, private domains. So I wanted to know whether this would mean some change in perceptions of English. If what people would think now that English is beginning to perform this role, people think that English is foreign now. Is this the foreign? Is this the colonialist thing that if for instance, you say, okay, away with English, what happens to those who use only English? Are you going to say that, are they less Nigerian because they do not use any indigenous Nigerian language? Yeah. Or has English by some of these become Nigerian? And I wanted to find out what people think, especially young speakers, what they think about this current status of English in terms of their own linguistic identity and linguistic repertoires as well. So this was my inspiration.
Right. Okay. And is that because English as a kind of world language, I mean, maybe not British English, but American English, for example, has kind of, you know, as you say, sort of penetrated so many parts of the world. It's in sort of cultural terms as well, you know, popular culture, music, it's the language of, I guess, the international language of kind of hip hop and things like that, but also, you know, film and TV. Is that maybe something that's kind of, I guess, sort of leading to English being seen as having a different kind of prestige that's not sort of governmental top down, but feels like it's something that younger people can pick up for themselves and find something in?
Yeah, I think the influence of America, especially American civilization, American culture, media culture, news culture, they are there, and there have been studies looking at the influence of American English on Nigerian English, for example.
Yeah.
And those studies have established some influence, significant influence, right? But Nigerian English is still largely pro-British. And if you ask many Nigerians, like I did, and part some of the items in my study, ask people what kind of English they speak. Some will say Nigerian English. Some will say British English. If you say the American English, but the percentage is still quite small. So I believe that while the influence is still there, I think the colonial history of English, and that most of the younger speakers just grew up speaking English, either from home or from school, because many Nigerians go to school quite early, and English has become the de facto language of instruction in schools, even right from nursery school, right from pre-primary school. Most schools just teach in English, even though the language policy says otherwise. Language policy says school children should be taught in the language of immediate environment. Again, a very nebulous term, but this has been defined as an indigenous language, all right? But this is only in principle, it's only in theory, it's only on paper. In reality, most schools, or I'm tempted to say all schools, both private and public, just teach children in English. So you find out that even children who use other languages at home have quite early exposure to English from school. So that English has become part of many Nigerians growing up from home or from school or from the wider social space. So English is just there. It just looms large anywhere you look. around you. From my experience raising my children in Nigeria before we moved to the UK, I found out that apart from home and maybe when we visit families and a few other places, every other place children just use English. They're in church, it is English. They're in their play groups, it's English. They're in school, it's English. Just home and maybe when they visit other family friends that they use Igbo, which is my L1.
Right, yeah.
So you find that it's just all over the place, but we cannot take away the influence of the American media culture and social media and all of that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, how do you feel about that personally?
Well, it's an ambivalent feeling for me, I must say, as a linguist. On the one side, I want to promote indigenous Nigerian languages. And on the other side, as a sociolinguist, I know it's not for linguists to legislate for people or whatever. Yeah. The more I had this foundation, one of the things that made me study linguistics, I was finishing secondary school, I was crazy about correctness of English. I was running a language program called English Police in Nigeria.
Right. Which, very prescriptive.
Which just speaks very, very prescriptive. But going into sociolinguistics, I've completely changed. So on the one hand, and just even though there are so many of such language police kind of programs and books and articles and columns in newspapers and all of that, the more you do that, the more people speak English the way they want to speak English.
Yeah.
And that's actually what drove me to Nigerian English studies. So it's not about legislating. So on the one hand, I know that if everybody spoke English, we are losing indigenous languages and these are cultural resources being lost. And I think about that, especially going into minority language studies now has opened my eyes more to the dangers, disadvantages of losing indigenous languages. That's on the one side. Another side is that people are thinking about usefulness. Our world is such a capitalist society that people are thinking about looking at languages as tools which they can use to achieve things. And this reminds me, one experience I've always shared is when I was doing interviews for my PhD, I was speaking to a student, a university student, final year student of political science in Lagos, Nigeria, a predominantly Yoruba-speaking community. And she did not speak Yoruba. She's a monolingual of English. And I wanted to find out why. And I found out, I think she did her secondary school in Ghana, away from family. And I think that contributed largely to that. But I asked, now that you are back studying in Nigeria, why have you not picked up Yoruba? Don't you think you are missing anything? She said, She asked me, what do I need Yoruba for?
Right, yeah.
He said, my boyfriend speaks English, and if we get married, we raise our children in English. And if I graduate, no company will interview me in Yoruba. It's English, and I will do my work in English. What do I need Yoruba for? Mm. And it's a question I tried to answer, but I'm not sure I succeeded in convincing her that Yoruba. I was coming from the cultural identity standpoint, but she didn't see that. And that to me defines how people perceive languages today. They are looking at languages as tools. So tools for economic advancement. So if English is the language I need to do this and to live life and make money and it satisfies that, then I do not need any other language. So it's I find myself in between. So on the one hand as a linguist, on the other hand as a sociolinguist, you know, you cannot legislate for people. You just have to describe what you see but people do linguistically.
It's interesting with those metaphors, you know, about things like language as a tool or kind of opening doors for you or holding you back. It does seem that's deeply embedded in the way we kind of talk about language. And like you when you started talking about English in Nigeria, you said it was kind of implanted. You know, it's lots of those kind of metaphors are really interesting, aren't they? Because they sort of convey a sort of mindset about it, don't they? And I think, as you say, that kind of capitalist kind of mindset, which is what can this do for me in terms of my potential to acquire capital?
Exactly.
You know, seems to be kind of quite hard-nosed, doesn't it? And almost as if the sort of cultural side is a bit of a sort of luxury.
It's when you have arrived, so to speak, that you can now bother. about the other cultural dimension.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And then it becomes, I guess, then that sort of cultural side tradition actually becomes more of a kind of middle class concern for those who've made it, if you like.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's perhaps when we talk about the accent reduction thing, it's also a very big factor.
Yes.
There.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's, you know, you were quoted in a BBC article recently about speakers of Nigerian English. I thought it was a really interesting article because I think I could see where the BBC writer was coming from, but lots of me, the sort of linguist in me, was kind of like, no, don't talk about language like that. That's wrong. And then you were quoted and I thought, oh, good, they got a proper linguist in here. Even then, a lot of that article seemed to be sort of, you know, parroting that kind of line that RP and sounding English in a kind of very RP way, you know, would be seen as being prestigious, as opening doors, as allowing people to kind of make something of themselves. But there's clearly something else going on there, isn't there? That sense of a pull of different directions, a sort of tension around identity and about success and economic success and things like that. You know, why do you think accent reduction lessons are being offered, and why do you think they're so popular, and what kind of feeds that sort of industry?
Well, yeah, I'm sure you know from that article, you know what my position is again. And I'm struggling to hold myself back from using very strong words. Right. But of course, I don't think anybody needs to reduce their accent for any reason. But if I was reflecting on what kind of thing fits into that attitude. And the point we just made about the upper class, right? Most people, rich Nigerians, because those who do this are actually children of the rich. Because from the teachers interviewed, you see that they pay heavily.
Yeah.
They pay heavily to do this. And first of all, I was thinking there is this saying in Nigerian pidgin, which came to mind while I was reflecting on this. There's this saying called, I pass my neighbor. All right? I pass my neighbor is a name given to a small power generating set, which you can buy. Of course, Nigeria has electricity problems. So it's called a pass my neighbor because if you can buy it in your neighborhood, you have light, but there will be darkness in your neighborhood. So you are demonstrating that sense of I am bigger,
yes,
right? I'm richer. I pass you. That's it's actually Nigerian pidgin. That's I pass my neighbor.
Right.
So I think that that philosophy of I pass my neighbor is something that is very, very rife in Nigeria and very, very pervasive. So more Nigerians are getting educated and more people are coming up towards the middle class. And I feel that this is my own. I mean, there's no research. This is my own analysis. And I feel that the upper class feel threatened that if we don't watch it, right, these people who are getting more educated, more exposed, traveling more, the world is connected more. Mm. If we don't step a bit further ahead of them, they're going to catch up with us and we're going to lose our social and economic relevance. So what do we do? Let's get something they can't get and let's have British accent. And that tells you what I said. There's still Nigerian English or Nigerian still, there's still a lot of gravitation towards British rather than American English. And that tells you most of these people do this towards RP, whatever that means. All right. And also, another thing is that most people in the upper class, the rich guys, right, they send their children to study overseas once they finish secondary school. Most of them come to the UK to study. So maybe they are doing this in terms of preparing them to adapt more quickly into the UK. And many of them, when they finish, they adapt, become British citizens. So maybe, I don't know, maybe why one of the reasons they are doing that is just they feel that would make their children adapt into the British culture more quickly.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, but research upon research has shown us that there is no evidence and that people who have reduced their accent perform better in any way. All right. And like I said, my accent is my identity, and people don't understand this. Accent is identity. My Nigerian accent is my Nigerian identity, and I preserve it very, very jealously, right? So one of my greatest motivations, I was listening to Professor Ayo Babuse, who is a renowned Nigerian linguist. He's retired now and no longer active, but he wrote a lot. Started writing as far back as 1960s and has traveled the world. I think this PhD in the US and has traveled a lot. So listening to him as an undergraduate, he said, my accent has never changed and it has never stopped me from going to anywhere I want to go. I have explored the world, I have taught the world, I've gone around the world teaching linguistics in America, in Europe, and I'm back in Nigeria and I feel fulfilled. And nobody has ever discriminated against me because of my accent. And that, I mean, that was his experience. People had discriminated against because of accent. All right. But like I said in that BBC article, I think those teachers who do this have just found a way to make money. Right. The money also drives all of this. Because in the end, those children will not learn British accent. That's it. Because even the teachers who teach them do not have the accent.
No.
So how are they going to learn it?
It did seem like a real scam. And like, I mean, I don't, you know, wouldn't want to cast aspersions on them because it would probably be libelous. But, you know, a lot of that industry does seem to be a bit of a grift.
Yes, yes. And that's the whole thing about, and that's the whole racist undertone also underlying the ALT industry. All right. People want to be associated with speakers from Britain, from speakers from America, or whatever thing that is. But even most of those people just find funny ways of pronouncing. And most of the things they say are not even British accent in any way.
No.
And as someone says, what even is British accent? When we talk about British accent, what exactly is it? The kind of accent you hear in London, if it is one, if there is one. I live in Newcastle upon Tyne.
Right.
And Newcastle people with this proud, jolly accent.
Yeah.
Right. Which I've become personally associated with and proud about as well. I don't have it, but I enjoy it. And I feel some kind of identified with it. Because, I mean, I've lived here for 7 years.
Yeah.
All right. So that's the thing. Okay. I said this in my doctoral thesis. Today's Nigeria, the English language curriculum is still purely British English.
Mm.
And that is the grandest irony I've seen. Because even in phonology, teaching spoken English, Nigerians are expected to pronounce these words. For instance, I give you an example, a word, sachet, S-A-C-H-E-T,
yeah.
Right? Pronounced sachet, right, in British English. But Nigerians, there's this popular water called sachet water. Or Nigerians say sachet, right? Yeah. Because the sounds, all the letters are pronounced, no silent letter there. It's very popular. It's called sachet water, right? Most Nigerians say sachet water, right? But in the curriculum, you're expected to say sachet water. So sometimes, even if you go to the people who do this business and tell someone, I want to buy sachet water, say, what do you mean? What do you mean? Most Nigerians don't know what is sachet, right? It's what everybody hears around them, including the students who are expected to say sachet, is sachet. And they will sound as these are two different things. It's the same thing. So it's ironical and surprising that Nigerian English educators and policymakers have refused to recognize that Nigerian English, and actually because it makes it difficult. And some of my participants say that one of the difficulties they find when they go into exams is that they go into exams or into classrooms, they see another kind of English. But they come out in their social space, is a different kind of English. And this causes problem. You write English that you hear around you in exams and you fail. And of course, year after year, examining bodies, WAEC and JAMB, are complaining about the failure rate in English. And English is compulsory subject. You have to pass English before you gain admission into the university. And it's frustrating a lot of people. And I've argued again and again that part of the reason why this is happening is that the kind of English they are expected to write and read from textbooks is different from the kind of English that they actually are familiar with.
I mean, it's an interesting argument as well, even in the UK, because it's you know, you've got a very similar standard language ideology around testing.
Yeah.
Maybe not quite as pronounced in as it might be in Nigerian English, but certainly students' home languages, the dialects they've got. You're talking about Newcastle, Geordie speakers will have their own grammar, which will not be permissible in an exam.
Exactly.
I mean, the debate is very live here as well. It's also ironic, you know, your example with sachet, which is, I've just looked it up. Etymology is French, isn't it? It's not even English.
Exactly. So if it was originally English, the Celtic origin, it would the T would be pronounced.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
Because it's French, yes. It's not pronounced. But that's it. Yeah.
So you've talked a bit about some of the work you've done about attitudes among Nigerian students in Nigeria, but also you've done a paper, I think, in 2022 with Folajimi Oyebola, which was about attitudes of expat Nigerians in Germany and the UK, two different varieties of English, including Nigerian English and British English. Can you just tell us a bit about what led to that research and what you discovered there?
Right. Paula, and who is a great friend and a great collaborator, we collaborate a lot. So we started talking about this because both of us, our doctoral dissertations focused on attitudes of Nigerians towards English, Nigerian English used in Nigeria. So in one of our conversations, we just taken, well, it might be good to look at our findings from our doctoral thesis and just oppose it with attitudes of Nigerians who do not live in Nigeria to see whether living outside would change people's perceptions and what people would think, specifically with Nigerian English, what they would think, because we found from my work and from my PhD and from his own PhD as well, that generally speaking, Nigerians demonstrated some positive attitudes towards Nigerian English. Mm. We wanted to know if Nigerians would demonstrate similar attitudes when they live outside Nigeria in an English-speaking country, in a predominantly English-speaking country like the UK, and a country where English is not predominant like Germany. So we used Nigerians from these two countries. And we found, well, I don't know what to say, maybe surprisingly, that most of them still retained that attitudinal affiliation to Nigerian English, but also to British English more than Nigerians who are in Nigeria, all right? And our explanation for that is, one, half of our participants live in the UK, so most of them have lived in the UK up to 10 years or more, so they have actually come, maybe beginning to identify with the accents of English they hear in the UK, like I did say, in a sense, identify with that Geordie accent. Right, even though I don't have it. Yeah, but also, similarly, the other subsample from Germany, similar thing, Nigerian English, but also British English, not America, and maybe perhaps because our explanation for this was that most Nigerians, even while in Nigeria, there's still that looking towards British English, but also most Nigerians in Germany or across other European countries actually end up settling in the UK. Because the UK is English speaking, most of them want to raise their children in the UK, which is English speaking, and all of that. So maybe also because of that, they tend to gravitate towards British English. But we found that most people, in terms of even from identity standpoint, identified with British English, but also as well as Nigerian English, but not the other varieties we tested, including Ghanaian English as well as American English.
I mean, it's very interesting that, isn't it? Because it suggests, I guess, as we already know, that identity is a complex thing around language, isn't it? And I guess there's always that sort of feeling about sort of a sense of like heritage, tradition, sort of family connections that can often make you more positive to something when you're further away as well.
Yeah.
But also, you know, that sense of being in a community and using a language around you might make you feel sort of affiliation towards it.
Exactly. And most of these Nigerians we found, raising, especially those who live in the UK, their children have a completely different accent from them, most of them said. So, and most of their children have British accent.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
While they retain their Nigerian accent. And maybe also, that wasn't so clear in the research, but maybe also saying that these are my children, these are my blood, they are my family, and I associate with them. So, British English has become part of me, part of my family, part of my identity, so to speak.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought of that connection. I mean, that certainly chimes with my experience of teaching in South London with quite a large proportion of West African students. You know, there were noticeable differences between the generations in family. So like at a parent's evening, mum and dad would come along with, you know, identifiably Nigerian English accent.
Yeah.
Student you've been teaching for 2 years would have a London accent, often MLE, probably not really much of a trace of Nigerian in their accent. But, you know, still feel some sort of cultural affiliation towards Nigeria.
Nigeria, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's identity is the most, especially linguistically, is the most complex thing. Mm. I was talking about a student who asked me, what do I need Yoruba for?
Yeah.
All right. In the end, she told me Yoruba is my native language, my mother tongue. But she didn't speak Yoruba. I said, why? He said, well, my parents speak it and I'm born into Yoruba family. Therefore, Yoruba is my native language. It's my mother tongue. And that's the whole complex thing about complexity about like linguistic identity and identification.
Mm.
That does it. So this British young Nigerians, young West Africans growing up in the UK, something that would need some further investigation to
be really interesting.
Look at their linguistic repertoire is something that
particularly
should be studied. Yeah. Thinking about it, a lot to do.
So, yeah, it'd be a great project, wouldn't it, to look at it over time, particularly. So moving from the personal to the abstract, I think A-level students will be quite familiar with some of the sort of big debates there have been around world English and global Englishes and around English as a lingua franca. Some of the sort of arguments there have been and the different, you know, the different tensions there. So what do you make of some of the sort of big debates there have been about, I guess, things like some of the kind of debates between, say, Braj Kashru and Quirk back in the 1980s and the sort of big ideas about what we should be talking about with English around the world?
Well, I think the whole force driving the debate is ownership.
Right.
I go back to that. Who should hold the freehold? Who has the freehold on English?
Yeah.
Who should command? Who should dictate? Who should determine? Who should provide the leadership in how English should be used and so that the others will follow? Right. And as you know, that Braj Kashru has argued, and I follow his framework a lot as well. The kind of position that Randolph Quirk and his colleagues were saying, that English belongs to the British Isles or the English people, and they should determine how it is used and all of that. That would have been possible maybe far back in the, before the 20th century, before English began to spread. But because the language, and I think this is Widdowson who has argued this again and again, and one of the people who first used the concept of ownership of English, said, once a language travels from one place to another, or another place, you can no longer control how that language behaves.
Mm.
And a small lesson from history of English tells us that originally English was not even originally an indigenous, autochthonous British language, right? This is the language of the two or three ethnic groups that migrated from West Germany, isn't it? The Angles and the Saxons and the Jutes, right?
Yeah.
Who came and displaced the original Celtic people who lived here. So looking at the language that was closest to the language that the Angles and the Saxons spoke, and maybe in the 5th or 4th century or so, was the Old English. All right, Old English is closest to what they spoke, what they bring. But if you bring Old English today and place it side by side with the English we speak today, they look completely like two different languages.
Yeah.
Unless you studied history of linguistics, you won't be able to relate. Yeah. It will take you time to even pick any word at all from Old English into English as it is today. All right. And that shows what happened is that these language of the West Germanic tribes, the Angles and the Saxons that migrated from West Germany into England, came and met another group of people, another culture, another language, another tongue, new terms that needed to be defined, new phenomena that needed to be defined that did not exist. So this language would change to accommodate these new realities, right? And that's what has also happened. So English has now developed, all right, out of these. And then English now began also to travel to the new world, as it was called first, to America, to New Zealand, to Canada, to Australia, and all of that. And as it did travel, it immediately started traveling. It loses that right, all right, because it's no longer spoken only within that small enclave, all right? Mm. This is something that happens to language many times. So my children, for instance, I give another instance. My children speak Igbo, right? And as well as English, because we try to speak Igbo at home. And sometimes my wife will say, it seems that the kind of Igbo these children speak is not the kind of Igbo I hear in Nigeria.
Yes.
Right? And I pay attention to that. And that's true, right? What's happening is that their general language repertoire, but specifically the Igbo, is influenced so much by English, not just English as a language, but also English as a culture.
Yeah.
They're speaking Igbo, which has been, I want to use again that metaphor of planting, uprooted, yeah, right, from where it was and now used here in the UK. So there are certain things they would not be able, and that's how language works. Once it moves from one place to another, all right, it behaves differently. Mm. And that different behavior shows that the people who use it determine how it should be used.
Yeah.
All right. And I told a story of what brought me into linguistics in the first place. I was crazy about bad English. Don't say this, don't speak this, speak this. And the more you told people don't speak this, the more they spoke what they wanted to speak, right? So that's people do with language what they want to do with it, and it is not something we can determine.
Yes.
So I think that debate is already closing up, because everybody now, well, certainly not everybody, because some of my professors, old professors back home in Nigeria, they ask me, what is this thing you're talking about, Nigerian English? What does it mean? Are you encouraging bad English? You want everybody to speak bad English, all right?
It's...
So certainly not, certainly not everybody. So it will take me time to see them and try to convince them, all right? And try to show them, and not just show them that there's Nigerian English. And they themselves use Nigerian English. And some of them will tell, no, I speak British English. And we had one of them who actually read here in the UK. No, so I speak British English and nothing but British English.
Old habits die hard, though.
But he doesn't have British accent. And
yeah,
I hear him use Nigerian English phrases all the time. So, but that's a debate for another day. The point I'm trying to make here is that it was Widdowson who said that the British people have lost English. All right. But even though I didn't, in my PhD, explain this, I don't believe they've lost it. They didn't lose it. All right. In the sense he said it. It just means that it's just for us to have an open mind and know that there is no one English, all right?
Yeah.
There are many Englishes, like Kachru has told us, many varieties of English, and that every variety is legitimate on its own right and should be acknowledged, should be respected, should be recognized as much as possible. And our world, it will be all the more better for it. Of course, in all of this diversity and variation in English, there is still something linguists, even world English, is recognized as the common core of English. The common core is what makes, when an Indian speaks English, I will understand. In my class, I also do some visiting teaching at Westminster University. I teach an MA course called World English Worldwide, right? In my class, I have only two British students. Mm. We are 20. The rest come from all parts of the world. Fantastic accents from all parts of the world, from Africa to Asia to Southern America and all parts of Europe. So, and I teach all of them. I come with my own Nigerian accent and Nigerian English most times. They understand me. And when they can make contributions in class, I understand them. And what makes it possible for us to communicate and understand one another is that common core, which is there, right? So you just recognize this variation this diversity, but still know that there's something that holds all of these varieties together, which is the common core of English.
And that common core is not received pronunciation standardized English.
Exactly. I mean, when it comes to when linguists talk about common core, it's usually in terms of grammar, usually in terms of how to put words together to form meaningful sentences. Of course, we know that English has this SVO, basic structure of this English sentence is SVO. So if you find another variety of English that has a basic structure as OSV, for example, that is moving away from the common core. When we talk about common core, it's more about grammar than accent, all right?
Yeah,
there
sure.
is hardly any common core in accent. Everybody's accent is...
Am I right in thinking that's kind of some of what Jennifer Jenkins has been doing with some of the stuff around the lingua franca core?
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So quick fire questions. What's your favorite book about language?
My favorite book about language is a book called Bad English with a subtitle, A History of Linguistic Aggravation.
I know this one. It's just Amon Shea, isn't it?
Amon Shea. Yeah. That's it. Who is the author of Reading the OED?
Right.
Yeah. I got to know about this book. That was 2019 when I was still doing my PhD. And when I picked up this book, I had to leave every PhD work until I finished the book. It was so, so beautiful to read. And even while I was thinking about this morning, I had to send the book. While I was thinking about my favorite book, I said, okay, I think Amon Shea's Bad English is up there for me. All right, because one thing this book did for me, or rather did to me, perhaps, is to it helped to change my perception. And it gave me the tool to talk to people, because I still have many friends and colleagues who hold so tight to correct English. This is bad English. And so if you read, you see how most of the words we use today, and nobody would think there's anything bad with it. The word like belittle, everybody says belittle. But when belittle started its life as an English word, most people thought it is crazy. How can you say belittle? It means nothing. And some people, the linguistic pet peeves did say that people who spoke such words should be killed, should be stoned. And that's how bad it was.
Yeah.
Right. But today everybody uses it and very normally. And that tells us not to judge people's language so much, because what we think today is bad English will become good English. And I use these words in quotes. All right. What we think today is bad English, the bad English of today is the good English of tomorrow.
Yeah.
So why judge people? Why discriminate against people because of their language, because of their accent? This is my best book for me. And this is why it is my best book.
So what's your favorite linguistic fact or idea?
I thought about this one long and hard, and I don't know. I think the fact that in the US, for instance, English is not an official language.
Mm.
And as well as in the UK, which is surprising. Many countries that are colonized by Britain specifically mentioned that the official language of this country is English. But where this English, the language is supposedly coming from, US, UK, there's no such clear official pronouncement that this is the official language. Maybe that's
I can kind of understand that in the UK, because so many of our rights are not really written down. But it's hard to believe in the US, where they got this kind of obsession with the Constitution.
Yeah.
And then finally, what one bit of advice would you give a budding linguist?
I'll keep it short. Keep an open mind and be ready to learn, because language is the most dynamic thing. It behaves in unpredictable ways. And to chase it up is to keep an open mind. Just look at what people do and analyze. As a linguist, that's just what I do. Don't be prescriptive. Be as descriptive as possible.
All right. Great advice. Thank you. So thanks very much, Kingsley. That's really interesting. Some really interesting sort of areas to take us into a discussion with students. So thank you very much for your insights and discussion of your own work.
All right. The pleasure is mine. Thank you so much, Dan, for doing this. It's my pleasure.
Hello. Hello and welcome to today's Lang in the News section, where we'll be taking a little hop, skip and a jump over a couple of stories to do with accent that have appeared in the last couple of weeks. There was some really nice research, new research published by Amanda Cole at the University of Essex and Pat Strahacek from the University of Manchester. They published some research about accents and dialects in the Southeast. We've got a nice link to a conversation article there where they talk through the findings of the research. And then this was picked up, as is often the case, by a couple of national newspapers. And it was covered by The Telegraph and The Daily Mail. And there's some really nice conversations to be had about the reporting on it there. Dan, do you want to start us off?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing that was published, I guess, was the paper which came out in September. And then Amanda wrote a piece for The Conversation about it. So that's quite a good place to go for the sort of factual side of it. We've actually got a quick interview with Amanda later on where she talks a bit about the kind of media coverage of it. So that's we'll cut to that later on. But yeah, I mean, The Telegraph did quite a kind of detailed take on it. That was quite an interesting read. There's a link to that in the show notes. And then, as you say,
we'll come to the Daily Mail reader comments in just a section because they're definitely the juiciest thing to talk about. But shall we just give a really quick rundown of what the research found?
Yeah. So, I mean, essentially what the study was about was looking at young people's language in the southeast of England. So they basically got a kind of algorithm set up on a computer to identify and cluster together different sounds. So as she puts it in The Conversation article, Amanda says, colleagues and I recorded the voices of 193 people between the ages of 18 and 33 from across Southeast England and London. They built an algorithm that then listened to how they spoke and then grouped them by how similarly they pronounced vowels in certain words, sort of vowel clustering. And basically they identified, or the algorithm identified, three significant accents, which they called Standard Southern British English, Multicultural London English, and Estuary English. And I guess the main finding was that really younger people aren't using Cockney, but also aren't using RP. And so that was the kind of pattern that was emerging, I guess, maybe a kind of accent leveling towards these three different accents, which seem to be the sort of main ones for young people.
Yeah, and this is a really lovely one to talk about with students if you're looking at language and diversity, or if you're looking at language and identity, and specifically around accent and dialect.
Yeah, and I think the thing that's interesting as well, as we suggested, is that the way that the newspapers cover it does reveal something about the way that certain concerns and preoccupations might weigh heavily on their minds. So, I mean, The Telegraph one was fairly straightforward and quite an accurate reflection of it. And then The Mail covered it. And The Mail's one wasn't too far out. In fact, I think Lisa noticed that there's actually some quite interesting sort of little linguistic diagrams they've included of like the shape of how sounds are produced in the mouth, things like that. That's quite technical, as well as pictures of Stormzy and Josh Widdicombe.
It's not a poorly reported article, honestly, at all. I think there's a little hint in sort of the opening line that Cockney and the King's English has been silenced by these other accents. And of course, that metaphor has an implicature that, I don't know, these accents are coming along and murdering the King's English. So there is a bit of an implicature there. But outside of that, there's not a huge amount of kind of super biased reporting on the research findings itself.
But
when you scroll down to the comments, there's some really vociferous reactions from the Daily Mail readers that kind of harken back to things that we've talked about quite a lot when we look at accent and dialect, people's ideas about why these things are happening. And as we've discussed previously, often a proxy for allowing them to talk quite disparagingly about various social groups. We're going to read some of them out. Jackie, do you want to pick one that you thought was quite choice?
Yeah, well, I mean, one that I thought was interesting was one that said, I listen to presenters today and cringe. Bring back the British well-spoken English, please. And I think this kind of links to the findings that talks about how 49% of the respondents in this piece of research used what they called Standard Southern British English, and how that would you describe it as a kind of a modification of RP, or somewhere in between RP and Estuary English? I'm not sure.
They said in The Conversation pieces that it's sort of a modern version of RP that sits between the two.
SSBE, which many perceive as a prestigious standard or neutral accent, is a modern updated version of RP. Yeah.
So I think, yeah, what we're kind of witnessing is the idea of what is perceived as well-spoken is perhaps changing, and younger people seem to be using a different accent perhaps to older people, and perhaps that difference between the two creates a level of tension.
Yeah. I mean, I guess as well, this research was focused on younger people. It might suggest actually that this is a longer change that's been happening as well, that this is not just the Gen Z all using this kind of new language like it's some sort of fashion, but it's maybe a kind of longer term shift, isn't it, away from RP, which would probably fit what other linguists have said over time about a move away from RP towards Estuary English in the late 80s, 90s, maybe MLE growing as well in other areas. Yeah, but it does seem to, it certainly seems to trigger some people, doesn't it?
Fairly well. It's a fairly well-rehearsed discourse, isn't it? Like our language standards are slipping. We should all be horrified, which probably isn't really borne out by reality. People seem to still be able to understand each other perfectly well. But it's the kind of argument that you hear time and time again.
Yeah. And I mean, I think when we look at some of the other comments as well, there's someone here who says, the country that gave us Shakespeare now reduced to the lowest common denominator, I think she tries to say at the end. And then somebody else says, in other words, if your speech is unintelligible, you are in. But if people can understand you, you are out. Mad, mad world. But it's I mean, that's just barking mad, isn't it?
But it's leaning on a discourse about clarity of communication that, again, is pretty well trodden, but isn't borne out in practicality, because the fact is you can understand the vast majority of people speaking English, even if their accent is fairly broad. But the accents that we're talking about here wouldn't be considered broad by lots.
No.
At all. They're actually relatively close together as accents go across the UK.
Yeah, they do seem to be like massive overreactions to it.
Yes, you've got dreadful accents. This sounds dreadful and casts doubt on their general intelligence, says one person. Men sound like schoolboys. They think it sounds cool, but it really makes them sound thick. So again, we have leaning on a discourse around your accent being a reflection of your intelligence, which again, we've seen before and seems to get rolled out a lot. That again has absolutely no basis in reality, as research has shown many times.
And there's also the idea that some accents are appropriate for particular positions in society. So there's one at the bottom by somebody called Prim and Proper from Birmingham. And she, I think, says, I heard a proper BBC announcer the other day, and it was like silk, so beautiful, as opposed to the horrible grating sounds that pass for regional accents we now hear on the TV. I've got a regional accent and not a nicer one, but I love to hear proper pronunciation and lovely diction.
The amount of self-hatred there is quite strong, isn't it?
But I think, I mean, it's funny, but it's also depressing, isn't it, that there is still, and these attitudes aren't going away, and the recent research by Sutton Trust supports the idea that some accents are seen as less fitting for the public to hear. So if you're going to be an announcer, or if you're going to be high up in the business world, there's a particular accent that you need to have. And those of us that don't have that accent really shouldn't be putting ourselves in positions where we're communicating with the general public.
What are you thinking, Jackie?
I'd be curious to know the ages of the commenters there on the Daily Mail article. Given that it's a study based on young people, I wonder if the responses would be different if they definitely were young people. And we don't know if they are on the comments, because of course they're sort of anonymized. But I'd be curious to know the sort of ages of the commentators. I suspect potentially older, but I wonder if that's my own bias about who I imagine comments under Daily Mail articles or under newspaper articles in general, because I don't imagine that there's many kind of early 20s people taking to their keyboards to make comments about things. I mean, in my brain, I conceive of it as maybe an older person's thing.
On the more positive side, though, there was another article about accent which suggested, this was in The Conversation just last night, and it was written by Alex Baratta, who's at University of Manchester, talking about how actually pretty much all accents are intelligible. And he points out, he says, my research shows there is no accent, whether used by a native speaker of English or a non-native speaker, that is inherently easy or difficult to comprehend. Rather, it's the lack of exposure people have to a variety of accents that can cause communication difficulties. And it's a really interesting piece. Well, again, we'll share a link to this in the show notes. But he's talking about the way in which
he's talking about familiarity, isn't he? How the degree to which you are familiar with an accent will correlate with how well you understand it. So those accents that we're regularly exposed to, we may perceive to be easier to understand or more intelligible. And those accents that are less familiar to us, we may perceive them to be unintelligible, but actually it's just we haven't maybe tuned our ears in.
Yeah. Yeah, which is actually a pretty good argument for exposing people to more accents, isn't it, throughout their lives, rather than trying to say, okay, we've got to reduce broader accents to make everybody intelligible. It's like, well, let's all hear more accents and we'll get used to them. And I think that's a much more positive message, isn't it?
Yeah, and he links to some training that takes place, Aviation Accents Training Program. And what they do there is they expose their airline personnel to clips of like a vast array of different accents, so that when they are listening to each other, they're not tripped up by not understanding or not being familiar with the accents of the people that they're working with. And that, to me, seems like a much more sensible approach, rather than suggesting that only people with RP accents can have these jobs.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So we're going to do a quick extra Lang in the News section for this episode, and I'm going to talk to Dr. Amanda Cole at University of Essex about a paper that she co-authored and the media responses to it. So thanks for talking to us, Amanda.
Thanks very much for having me on.
So you did a paper which was published in September, and there's been quite a lot of media coverage about it. Do you want to just tell us a bit about the paper itself, what you were looking at, and then talk us through some of the media reaction to it?
So the paper itself was based on us trying to determine what are the accents spoken in Southeast England. So we had around 200 people, so young people, all from across the Southeast and London. And we used a computer algorithm to split them into groups, basically, based on how similarly they spoke to each other. So the algorithm came up with three groups, which we then labelled as standard Southern British English, Estuary English and Multicultural London English. And we kind of labelled them in that way because the distribution of accent features was very similar to the way that those accents have been previously described. We didn't find necessarily there was like a very sort of, you know, a typical Cockney accent that came out, or an RP, so more like received pronunciation, Queen's English accent. Mm-hmm. And then this was picked up in the media, and there's been a sort of bit of flurry of attention based on that.
You've been interviewed by 5 Live, Radio 4. You're on LBC last night talking about it. I think was it in the US as well? You did an interview.
Yeah, on The World, which is a US radio station. And then a few sort of regional ones. So I was on BBC Essex, BBC Berkshire.
And so in terms of just going back to the articles and things like that. So the first one was you'd written it up for The Conversation, and then The Telegraph ran quite a big story of it, didn't they? How did you feel about the kind of way they covered it?
So I think The Telegraph coverage of it was quite, you know, it was quite true to what we'd written in The Conversation. I think The Conversation is great in a way because it allows you to really put forward your message, like as an academic, of what you think to be found and the interpretation of it. So I often like to write that first and then kind of allow the media to pick out of that rather than the other way around, as it means that, you know, you're not being misinterpreted and you can really make sure that what you put in will then be reported. And of course, with any sort of media coverage of it, there's always going to have to be a certain spin to it. They want to find something that kind of hooks people in. And there's always going to be content that isn't taken, you know, from our mouths or isn't things that we've written. So there's always that kind of slightly delicate balance of being like, what is my research and how is that presented? And what's the kind of framing of that? And sometimes you kind of want to distance yourself from it a little bit, I think, because you think, okay, that is my research, but I don't necessarily agree with how that's been framed.
Yeah. I thought there was an interesting bit in the interview you did with, I can't remember which one it was now, which was the one where you said we wouldn't frame it like that, but...
Oh, I can't remember.
One of the BBC ones, wasn't it, I think? The Essex one.
I think...
Oh, no, the ITV one, wasn't it? When it came to you and you said, we probably wouldn't frame it as da-da-da-da-da, but...
Yeah, because I think the sort of more interesting narrative in the media is that, you know, Cockney and Queen's English are dead. They're not spoken anymore. They've been replaced. But I understand that that's something that's going to hook people in. But it's obviously, we would caveat that a lot more and we would put a lot more nuance behind that. And also, I feel like terms like replaced can have a lot of, they have like a sort of moral load to it. And I think sometimes that can be kind of misinterpreted. So I think we have to be really careful with framing anything as replacement, as, you know, accents change and new accents emerge. But replace can make it feel like, you know, one accent or one group of people have like pushed another accent, a group of people out of the way and kind of, you know, like a cuckoo, like laying, you know, its eggs in the nest of another bird.
Yeah.
So I think I was like slightly pushing back against that framing of like replacement, whereas I think it's just a natural process of accents changing.
Yeah. I mean, as you say, it doesn't take much, does it, for some people to kind of jump on that sort of framing of it and come out with like quite appalling responses. You've seen stuff, comments online about your articles in the Telegraph, and the Mail covered it as well. And some of the stuff on there is just beyond the pale, isn't it? I mean, it's just nakedly racist. So
yeah, I mean, I think sometimes the article can even be quite sensitive and you think, oh, that was okay. But then you can read the comments and you do get this whole other side to it. And I think part of the problem as well with the framing of, you know, BBC English or Queen's English is no longer spoken, is that that kind of brings up this idea of like language decay or people not speaking correctly anymore, which I think is something that a lot of people kind of have latched onto. Of course, that's not at all how we would have wanted to position the research, as that takes as the sort of central tenet of it, that Queen's English is better or is superior or is more correct. And obviously we don't agree with that anyway. So, you know, if an accent is lost, but it's not considered prestigious or, you know, in any way superior, then there's no sort of problem with that.
Yeah.
So I think what was quite beneficial as well is that we showed that also Cockney is maybe not an accent that's spoken as predominantly as well. So there were these two accents from opposite poles that we're saying have kind of not been like lost, but, you know, have evolved into new accents, which is probably more reflective of dialect levelling than anything else.
Yeah. And do you think in any of the coverage, they've kind of got completely the wrong end of the stick or misinterpreted what you said in the way that they've covered the paper?
I think I've probably been quite fortunate having the conversation article there first, that sort of set the narrative. So I think, fortunately, I actually don't think there's been the case where I've read something and gone, whoa, that's been completely misinterpreted, or that's a spin that, you know, I never intended. Obviously, there's a journalistic flair added to all of the content. But fortunately, I don't think there's been anything that I'm like, well, we really need to like push back on that, because I think that's completely, completely out of line with what we intended.
Although, wasn't there something in the Mail one where the kind of captions to the images of the celebrities they were using these examples, didn't they claim that this was caused by celebrities?
Yeah, I think there was this idea that, and I can't remember the exact wording, but like the idea that like these celebrities have made these accents popular and, you know, now young people want to do it. Almost like it's a trend, like, you know, you see a celebrity wearing a certain shoe and you're like, oh, I think I should get that shoe. Almost like, you know, Ellie Goulding invented standard Southern British English and then everyone else was like, oh, that's cool. So I think I'll do it too. If it's good enough for her, it must be good enough for me.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, instead, we're not saying that these people like are like emblematic of the accents or, you know, have invented them. We're saying that they probably have those accents because they too have been communicating and talking to people and have been subject to the same sort of patterns of like linguistic variation change that all of us are when, you know, we live in the society.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. Thank you very much.